Mr. President, the weight of evidence to prove Ugandan complicity has been growing by the day as the detailed statements of the hostages are analyzed and new evidence becomes available. We now know from the debriefing of the passengers that the map in the hands of the leader of the hijacking group, Wilfred Boeze, which he produced immediately after the plane took off from Athens, was already clearly marked with the route Athens, Benghazi, and Tebe. We know too, as has been indeed published, that before the arrival of the plane at Entebbe, Idi Amin dispatched his personal plane to Somalia in order to pick up and bring to Entebbe the leader of the terrorists who took control of the plane after it landed at Entebbe. Furthermore, the distinguished members of the council are fully aware by now that four terrorists hijacked the plane at Athens. The evidence which I have produced and which many other distinguished delegates have confirmed shows that the plane was met at Entebbe Airport by reinforcements, five in number. Four terrorists hijacked the plane. Seven terrorists were accorded a state funeral with full military honors by the government of Uganda. In other words, by all accounts, including impliedly by Ugandan accounts, terrorist reinforcements appeared on the scene in Entebbe. In fact, we know they were driven onto the scene in two official Ugandan cars, one driven by a soldier in uniform. Shortly after 101 hostages were released on the 1st of July, the following dispatch was sent from the Associated Press in Paris. Quote, "Hostages newly released by hijackers of an Air Force jetliner arrived here early today and said three or four heavily armed men, apparently Arabs, were waiting to reinforce four original hijackers when the plane commandeered over Greece landed in Entebbe in Uganda," unquote. After the Israeli rescue operation, the French newspaper Le Monde gave full details of this aerial piracy in its issue of the 5th of July, which included the following, and I quote, "À leur arrivée à Kampala, ils ont été rejoints sur la piste tout de suite après l'atterrissage par une groupe de quatre ou cinq Palestiniennes armées de mitraillettes." Unquote. Similar reports appeared in many other newspapers, magazines, and on many radio and television stations. All reports were based on information given by released hostages and government officials. There is not the slightest of doubt in anyone's mind that, in fact, the hijackers were reinforced in Uganda. Furthermore, the important role played by the terrorists who joined the hijackers at Kampala adds further proof that also the Entebbe part of the hijacking was a carefully planned operation which could not have been carried out without the complicity of the government of Uganda. If Uganda was not implicated, how did it happen that these reinforcements were allowed to drive up? Why have those distinguished delegates who have identified themselves in so moving a manner out of a feeling of common interest with Idi Amin's Uganda and with the cause of international terror not addressed themselves to this rather strange development, which in itself proves their thesis to be false? Furthermore, if there was no connivance, where are the other terrorists? What has happened to the two or three survivors of the rescue operation at Entebbe Airport? Why have they not been apprehended and produced in accordance with the Hague Convention of 1970? In my statement on Friday, I already referred to the fact that the terrorists, always aided by the Ugandans, interrogated some Israelis, at times using force and even threats of death. The New York Times of Sunday, July the 11th, carried a vivid description of one such interrogation conducted both by the terrorists and the Ugandans, and I quote, "During one period of questioning by the terrorists about what he really knew about Israel, Mr. Dahan was slapped in the face, punched in the back, and his fingers were twisted backwards. He was told to write long reports about Israel and proceeded to turn in documents dealing with kibbutz life and how he picked grapefruit. After one of these exercises, a Ugandan tore the paper out of his hand and threw it on the floor, saying, 'This is not what we want. We want to know about the army. We want to know where the bases are. We want the name of your general. A tall Palestinian carrying a gun and another called George joined four Uganda officers in the questioning. At one point, George put a gun to Mr. Dahan's chest, unquote. In view of the overwhelming body of evidence corroborated by most of the 260 passengers and crew of the hijacked plane, I am left with no other choice but to call the two statements of the Foreign Minister of Uganda as nothing but the most formidable collection of distortions, half-truths, deliberate omissions, and outright falsehoods that this council has heard in a long time. I shall not tire the council by listing each and every distortion. They are too numerous to count and would prove to be very time-consuming. However, Mr. President, there is one abominable lie upon which my country cannot pass in silence, and it is incumbent upon me to show the true face of the President of Uganda and his Foreign Minister for what they are. The Foreign Minister of Uganda stated before this Security Council that, and I quote, when she, Mrs. Bloch, got better in the evening of Saturday, the 3rd of July, she was returned by the medical authorities to the old Entebbe airport to join the other hostages. The Israelis committed a naked act of aggression by invading Entebbe airport, where the hostages, including Mrs. Dora Bloch, were being held by the house of the invading force, took away all the hostages, dead, injured, or otherwise. The press reports and diplomatic sources, according to which one diplomat saw Mrs. Dora Bloch in hospital on Sunday, are false. There is no concrete information about it. So much for the statement by the Foreign Minister of Uganda before this council. I repeat, Mr. President, this is a damnable lie. Mrs. Bloch was visited in a hospital by a British diplomat on Sunday, the 4th of July, after Israel's rescue operation at Entebbe Airport, as was clearly stated to this council by the distinguished representative of the United Kingdom. The diplomat reported that she was being guarded by two men, and when he returned an hour later, he was not allowed to see her. That diplomat, we were informed yesterday by the distinguished representative of the United Kingdom, is to be expelled today from Uganda. We now have the ominous news that the government of Uganda is applying the threat of blackmail to foreign nationals in Uganda in connection with the current proceedings in the Security Council. In other words, for the first time in history, a direct attempt is being made by threats of blackmail of the most ominous character to influence the proceedings in this council. How can this council pass over this in silence? How can it ignore a blatant attempt to influence this body? How can the members of this council ignore this flagrant attempt to interfere with their national sovereignty? This whole sordid affair condemns not only the government of Uganda, but all the countries which have spoken out against the Israeli rescue mission on this issue at this table. They have ignored the basic cause of this issue, namely the hijack, have not even had the good grace, for reasons of political expediency, to say one word about the fate of an old lady of 75 dragged out of the hospital to the horrible fate meted out to tens of thousands of Ugandans, a fate the nature of which has been described by the distinguished Foreign Minister of Kenya in his letter addressed to you today, sir. With all due respect to the distinguished Foreign Minister of Mauritius and to other members who joined him in condemning Israel, the fact that they did not see fit even to mention in passing the fate of Mrs. Bloch and did not see Ugandan authorities in removes from them to any standing in this debate. The case of Mrs. Bloch only emphasizes in a most tragic manner the scope, and let me quote from a statement by Mr. Yigael Allon, our foreign minister, in the disappearance of Mrs. Bloch constitutes an inseparable hijacking incident. The fate which befell her gives vivid substance to the awful danger which threatened the passengers at Entebbe, read in the magnificent rescue operation conducted by the Israel Defense Forces. It also proves for once and forever how empty and devoid of conscience alike were those voices which rushed to condemn Israel in the international arena for carrying out the elementary duty towards its citizens and saving them from this awful danger. Unquote. One's mind tends to be dulled and one's memory to be hazed as the debate goes on in this council. Let me remind the council that we are talking about a decision by the government of Israel to protect its citizens, hostages threatened with their very lives, over 100 held at gunpoint by terrorists who had hijacked them, who recognize no sovereignty, know no law, and who have proved in the past that there are no limits to their bestiality, who shot diplomats bound hand and foot, who murdered sportsmen at the Olympics, and who in the past have held children hostage and were ready to slaughter them. This is by a government headed by a racist murderer who had applauded the slaughter of Israeli sportsmen bound hand and foot, who had called for the extinction of Israel in this United Nations, and who had not only praised Hitler for the murder of 6 million Jews, but had proposed a move which prompted even the Soviet ambassador in Kampala to suggest to President Amin that he was going too far. This was the problem which faced the government of Israel. Over 100 men, women, and children, with terrorist guns pointed at them, and having no doubt whatsoever in anybody's mind, terrorists, to carry out their wicked, innocent people as they have done. This is the picture which must be in the mind's eye of the discuss this problem. I regret many of the remarks made by the representative of Tanzania because I suspect that they do not reflect his true feelings or the true feelings of the government of Tanzania. I reject out of hand to equate this Israeli rescue operation to save its on Africa. How can the distinguished representative of Tanzania make such a remark? Would Africa have looked better if Palestinian terrorists, in connivance with President Amin, had slaughtered over 100 men, women, and children? Would Africa have looked better with their blood, the blood of these innocent victims bespattering the soil of Africa? Who has besmirched Africa? Israel, for exercising its right to save its citizens in accordance with international law, or that racist regime in Uganda, waging a heroic war against a defenseless old lady of 75? Who is threatening Africa? Israel, which has done so much to help so many African countries, including many today in the field of agriculture, of technology, of health, or the country which has dispatched this week 30 fighter planes as reinforcements to Uganda, namely the government of Libya? Against whom are these planes directed, and by whom are they flown? You know as well as I do that they are directed against Kenya and Tanzania, who have been threatened and continue to be threatened openly in statements by the president of Uganda, and that the planes are flown, amongst others, by PLO pilots. Who is threatening Africa and the Africans? Israel, whose refusal to be associated in any way with President Amin's proposal to invade and bomb Tanzania in 1972 brought about Uganda's break with Israel, or the head of the state who produced in Israel and in other countries, incidentally, maps describing his plans to invade Tanzania? Who has treated Africa with contempt, if not the president of Uganda, who has labeled the president of Tanzania a man of international stature and standing, in words which are despicable and disgusting, and which I do not wish to repeat because of the high regard which I and my people have for the president of Tanzania? The distinguished representative of Tanzania says he would have preferred principles to be given priority over expediency. What principles are you talking about? The principles of Uganda, which are reflected in the grim recital of murder, kidnapping, and banditry in the document distributed today by the distinguished Foreign Minister of Kenya? Have you said one word here against these Ugandan principles? Is it principle or expediency which brought you, the distinguished representative of a very distinguished country, to be a co-sponsor of this resolution with Libya, the paymaster and center of world terrorism, and the country which is supplying fighter aircraft to Uganda? You know as well as I do that those planes will not be used by Uganda against Israel. If you, my dear friend, wish to discuss principles and expediency, by all means, let us do so. But let us spell them out, too. Let us not be selective about principles and expediency, just as we should not be selective about terror and rescue operations. Mr. President, I can only reiterate what I said on Friday. Let us stop being selective. If terror is bad, it is bad everywhere, for everybody, and on every occasion. If it is bad, whatever the color, race, creed, or nationality of the terrorist. It is bad, whatever the color, race, creed, or nationality of the victim. That is the issue before us. That is the issue with which the United Nations has failed to deal. That is the issue which will plague the whole world until we deal with it. I listened to the remarks of the distinguished representative of Pakistan. Frankly, I would have accorded them more respect if they had not come from the delegate of a regime which has locked up its entire political opposition in jail. Here was the miserable apparition of the representative of a state whose own people were brutally driven out of Uganda by the racist regime of Idi Amin, falling over himself to ingratiate himself with the oppressors of his own kith and kin. How despicable can one be? The distinguished representative of the Soviet Union asked me why we did not quote the documents of the United Nations banning aggression in international relations. The distinguished representative of the Soviet Union must be aware that the definition of aggression adopted by the General Assembly on the 15th of December 1974 has been widely criticized in all legal circles. It is not a binding statement of international law and does not incidentally rule out an act like that carried out by Israel. When the distinguished delegate of the Soviet Union asked why Israel did not file a complaint to the Security Council, I don't know whether he is naive or he assumes that I am naive. Let me assure him that at least in this respect, I cannot be characterized as such, and I have no doubt but that he is anything but naive. I asked a distinguished representative of the Soviet Union, had we submitted a complaint, would the Soviet Union have supported us? Why was there no Soviet statement when the plane was hijacked? Why have they not condemned the terrorist acts of the PLO on many occasions in the past? Why did they not issue a statement or an appeal when the innocent hostages were being held in Entebbe? Why didn't the distinguished representative of the Soviet Union have even one word to say about the fate of Mrs. Dora Bloch? Or one word of appeal directly to the representative of Uganda in this respect? After all, you have influence in Uganda. Is the distinguished representative of the Soviet Union not aware that since 1954, the Soviet Union has blocked every attempt on the part of Israel to bring its case to the Security Council? For 22 years, we have had no remedy in this council because of the Soviet veto. We are used, Mr. President, to cynicism in this body, but the cynical question of the representative of the Soviet Union, why didn't we complain to this council, when he knows in advance that without regard to the substance of the claim he would have vetoed it, is, I submit, the height of cynicism. I note the Soviet representative's concern for the inviolability of African territory, and I sincerely trust that his touching concern will be reflected in Soviet Union policies and actions. The distinguished representative of the Soviet Union talked about aggression and the inviolability of territorial integrity and national sovereignty. On these subjects, I defer to him, having regard to the Soviet Union's very considerable record in these respects in Hungary, in Czechoslovakia, and in other countries in Eastern Europe. My distinguished colleague from China could doubtless elaborate on this subject. Let me assure the distinguished delegate of the Soviet Union that the people of Hungary in 1956 and of Czechoslovakia in 1968 would have been only too delighted if the Soviet intervention had been to save 100 hostages and had been of a duration not exceeding 53 minutes, as was the case at Entebbe. At that time, the Soviet Union went to great pains to explain its position. Sergei Kovalev, in Sovereignty and the International Duties of Socialist Countries, published in Pravda on the 26th of September 1968, explained the Soviet Union's justifications of such actions as follows, and I quote, "Those who talk about the, quote, illegal, unquote, actions of the Allied socialist countries in Czechoslovakia forget that in a class society there is not and there cannot be law that is independent of class," unquote. "Mr. President, in a civilized society, there is not and cannot be law that is independent of the loftiest principles of man, namely freedom and dignity of man. That, my distinguished colleague from the Soviet Union, was the principle that Israel was defending at Entebbe." Perhaps the more indicative of all in attitudes of governments was the document from Algeria circulated to this council and which was welcomed yesterday by the representative of the Soviet Union. It is indeed appropriate that Algeria should speak out for the terrorists and hijackers, having regard to the fact that it was Algeria to which the first hijacked plane in operations against Israel in 1968 was directed. Algeria was directly involved in that operation and blazed the way for future terrorist exploits. One could hardly expect Algeria, which has played such a prominent part in the history of air hijacking, international kidnapping, and the use of diplomatic immunity for terrorist purposes, to forfeit its place in the Hall of Fame of international terrorism. They had to get into the act. After all, what Amin did 2 weeks ago, they did in 1968. Mr. President, in the course of all these discussions, some delegations have tended to ignore the group which organized this hijacking, namely the PLO. The PLO has issued a statement disassociating itself from this operation. This is a lie. The PFLP, to which the hijackers belonged, is a constituent member of the PLO. The PLO's record policy is a matter of record. It is one based on the most brutal terrorism, in the course of which attacks have been made upon innocent people, including unsuspecting women and children. These gangs have cut down pregnant women in cold blood in Kiryat Shmone, have shot Olympic athletes bound hand and foot, have hijacked planes, have engaged in open assassination, have held small school children hostage in Maalot, causing the death of over 20 children and over 60 wounded. These are the same individuals who tried to impose a reign of terror on the Palestinian Arabs in the West Bank and Gaza, killing cold-bloodedly those suspected of not agreeing with them. These are the people who have been instrumental in destroying the Lebanese state, tearing it apart while this council remains silent, killing tens of thousands and wounding thousands of others. These are the people who have brought misery, murder, and assassination to the area of the Middle East, and who have introduced terrorism as a form of international idiom. Terrorism which affects innocent people wherever they may be. I note too, if I am already discussing Arab compliance and terrorism, that the government of Egypt has co-sponsored the decision of the OAU to bring this matter before the council. Let me remind the council that the government of Egypt released the cowardly assassins who shot Prime Minister Wasfi Tal of Jordan on the steps of the Sheraton Hotel in Cairo and who then drank his blood. The government of Egypt released the terrorists in 1970 from the Black September organization who landed the hijacked Pan-American jumbo plane in Cairo airport and blew it up at that airport. Mr. President, I listened carefully to the long drawn out point of order yesterday made by the representative of Libya, and I must admit I quite appreciate his concern, which was expressed by him today too. Who but the representative of Libya, a country which has been the paymaster and haven of international terrorism, would want to avoid a discussion in this council on this evil international terrorism? Libya's role in supporting international terrorism financially, militarily, and politically, and its involvement in assassination attempts of foreign leaders, including Arab heads of state, is known to all of us, and I need not repeat it here. However, the motivation behind the timing of the point of order is quite clear in view of information revealed over the weekend by the President of Egypt. In an interview with the Egyptian newspaper Akhbar al-Yom, as reported by the Middle East News Agency on the 10th of July, President Sadat, who only last week expelled the Libyan ambassador for complicity in acts of terror, discussed publicly and on the record Libya's criminal involvement in international terror. It is apparent that Libya is the haven and refuge for the most wanted international terrorists whose colleagues were among those who carried out the hijacking of an Air France plane to Uganda. Indeed, while the deliberations in this council were proceeding, forces financed and backed by Libya were actively continuing subversive operations in Sudan against the government of Sudan. What further evidence is necessary to prove that Libya has forfeited its right to vote on this question, and indeed is disqualified to be a member of the Security Council, a body charged with the duty to promote international peace and security. Mr. President, in conclusion, may I express my appreciation to those delegates who had the courage to take a stand clearly and unequivocally on the side of human decency and human freedom and against the scourge of international terror, and those countries who support it, whether by commission or omission. The eloquent and moving statement by the distinguished representative of the United States of America, Governor Scranton, and the call of all the other delegations who urged this body to take action must evoke an echo throughout the world, regardless of political differences. I urge those countries who have already expressed their views on this issue at this table to join together to take action against hijackers and international terrorism. I am sure that many will follow their lead. This meeting will decide in more ways than one whether the United Nations will continue its downward path in the grip of despots or will reassume its rightful role on behalf of humanity and international peace. Thank you, Mr. President.